Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vanderkirk speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you the news of the world. New German attacks on the edge of the Saar Basin, some distance from the original breakthrough area, are conceded to have gained ground. Where the Third Army is on the offensive near Bastogne, General Patton's veterans have pressed the Germans back for 2 more miles in extremely heavy fighting. American flyers, whose swift movement does not always qualify them as good observers, have reported von Rundstedt as moving 2 of his armored columns in the direction from which they came. Sir Bertram Ramsay, top Allied naval commander in Europe, has been killed in a plane crash. And now a word from Charles Lyon.
This announcement is for the attention of you folks who, because of no apparent reason, don't feel quite up to par. Now, maybe you attribute that dull, tired, nervous, irritable feeling to getting old, but one of the causes might very well be a dietary vitamin B complex deficiency. Now, that means simply that your food may not be supplying you with all the B-complex vitamins you ought to have. So a wise thing to do is fortify your food with a single, one-a-day brand vitamin B-complex tablet every day. Only one tablet every day. And this one tablet provides your full, basic daily amounts of all the B-vitamins whose requirements are known. That's an easy way to make sure you're getting at least the basic requirements of the B-complex vitamins. And it's an economical way, too. Just try one-a-day brand B-complex and see. Tell your druggist you want one-a-day brand vitamin B-complex tablets made by the makers of Alka-Seltzer. Look for the big one on the gray package. Now back to John W. Vanderkirk.
General Patton is going, if not great guns, at least medium-sized guns in his vigorous counteroffensive against the southern corner of the Nazi breakthrough wedge. The relief of the old road-crossing town of Bastogne has put the Third Army in possession of a main highway that points conveniently enough just in the right direction. That double-width Macadam Road is the spine along which General Patton's light tanks, infantry, and supply vehicles are being moved forward, and from which they are being deployed through the surrounding hills and woods to deal with the increasing enemy pressure at either side. Many days have passed since the field commander of the Nazi operation, von Model, has attempted to push any farther to the west. Just the same, it is probably much too soon to say, as some of the correspondents are saying, that the German offensive has been stopped. An offensive, to be really worthy of the name, in both senses of the word, is not a single operation, but a series of continuing operations. Until yesterday, the only glint of silver in the cloud of dark news was the knowledge that the long Allied battle line in Western Europe had not been altered anywhere except in the immediate Luxembourg-Belgium breakthrough area. Though the First Army had been sent back like a willow switch below Aachen, the positions won with such great difficulty east of Aachen on the approaches to Cologne have all been held. We've had no reports of any American withdrawal from the near banks of the Roar River. Nazi patrols in force against the Canadian and British sections of the line in Holland have been uniformly intercepted and thrown back. For 2 weeks, therefore, one could say that von Rundstedt had extracted no useful byproducts from his surprise assault. Now the first of those byproducts are beginning to be won. During the hours of winter darkness at the very beginning of the new year, enemy units were ordered to advance against a quite different part of the American line, about 70 miles away to the southeast. Those initial attacks took place almost exactly at the dividing line between those two portions of the front held by the 7th and the 3rd Armies. The Germans reported that major forces had just been withdrawn from that region. That secondary Nazi attack at once began to make progress. The enemy commander had chosen to repeat the familiar trick of prodding at the theoretically weak point where 2 armies join. Today we have the admission from headquarters that the enemy's effort has now expanded into the region just to the north, held by the 3rd Army, and that Nazi gains have been achieved on the edge of the Saar Basin. That's a territory which was attacked with such energy by General Patton just before he and much of his available strength were hauled off to give vital help toward narrowing the original German bulge. The weather, for once, has been on our side. Yesterday and today, in the area where the enemy's attempting another breakthrough, have been blessed with bright skies. The German columns, during the short hours of daylight at least, have been constantly harassed by Allied air attacks. Due partly to that help from overhead, the enemy's path of penetration southeast of the Saarland fortified hill town of Beech has been held down to a width of 5 miles. It would be idle to pretend, though, that this latest German move is not almost as alarming in its possible potentialities for danger as was the initial Nazi attack of December 16th. And now for the first of our shortwave broadcasts from overseas, I switch you to NBC in Western Europe.
Anderson speaking from Belgium. The awaited second German thrust along the northern edge of the salient in Belgium has not yet developed. Though it is still too early to say that it won't come, the delay in launching a new attack from the Meuse River has permitted the Allies to thicken up a defensive-offensive wall around the three sides of the salient, and a surprise German attack is now out of the question. Three main factors have stopped the German offensive aspirations for the time being. Foremost among these is the American wedge driven into the salient in the region of Bastogne. As proved by the early course of this battle, the Germans had no intention to continue a southerly drive. But every time they tried to push in a northwesterly direction, toward Liège, the spearhead was pushed down, pushed in a direction where German strategic gains would be a minimum. Now, the southern portion of the salient sticks out like a thorn in the flesh to a victory-hungry German Wehrmacht. General Patton's Third Army wedge, driven up from the area of Bastogne, is forcing the Germans to look more and more over their shoulders. Their lines of communication for a northwesterly drive are now anything but secure. The Allied Air Force is another factor which has helped to slow down the tide of battle in the salient. Though very little direct support could be given inside the salient during the past 2 days, Allied bombing attacks just behind the line, the battle area, have prevented much-needed reinforcements and supplies from reaching the front. The all-out German effort to smash Allied airfields in Belgium and Holland yesterday is taken here as a flattering compliment to the work being done by our air forces. Weather is the third factor. Tonight, a cold, brisk wind whips across the battle area. Frost, snow, rain, and ice make travel hazardous, if not impossible. Allied patrols have been able to penetrate as much as 3,000 yards in one sector of the salient without making contact with the Germans. Can this mean that the Germans are falling back to a new defensive position? Meanwhile, the synergistic fighting continues. And now back to NBC in New York.
And next, we take you to a very different climate, to a microphone in the equatorial tropics, close to another battle line. I switch you to NBC in the Pacific.
This is George Thomas Foster speaking from the Philippines fighting front. The news has just spurted up to us here in the Philippines that a British fleet has arrived in Australia. These British fighting ships and aircraft carriers will be under the command of Sir Bruce Fraser, who will in turn be under the command of Admiral Nimitz. 2 weeks ago, when we first heard that a British fleet was expected, I speculated on this program whether or not Great Britain would be able to send her own cruisers and destroyers, her own screening forces with the big battleships and carriers. Well, it seems she has, which in itself is a concrete indication of the growth and present strength of the King's Navy. Our American Navy is the biggest in the world, and there is no doubt about it that it is strong enough to take on the Japs and wipe them out of the Pacific. So you might ask, why this sudden appearance of the British fleet in the Pacific? Well, first of all, it isn't sudden. It has been in the plan for a long time, but this business of a screening force has kept them away. Over a year ago, we could have had a number of big British carriers and battleships, but neither Great Britain nor ourselves had the fast, smaller craft to protect and round out such a task force at that time. Some people are asking if the Australian squadron that is attached to our 7th Fleet here in the Southwest Pacific will change over now and work with the British. I don't think they will. In the first place, they have worked too well and too long with us, and have had to undergo a complete retraining program. The Australian ships had to change their guns' breech blocks so that they could use our American ammunition. To save time and dispense with this complex retraining program, it seems logical to expect that this full-size British fleet just arrived will work as an independent unit, carrying out Admiral Nimitz assignments under Sir Bruce Fraser's orders.
That completes our report from the Philippines. We take you now to NBC in Washington.
This is Morgan Beatty in our nation's capital. The most important decision of the new Congress convening tomorrow is being made behind the scenes by the two major parties in the Senate. They're picking the men who will ratify American foreign policy. The struggle is intense for position on the most important single group in the United States today, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. There are 5 vacancies to be filled in that group, 3 Democratic and 2 Republican. 8 Democratic senators, some of them newcomers, and 5 or 6 Republicans are being considered for the select circle, making 13 in all to fill 5 vacancies. Prominently mentioned for the Democratic positions are Senators Hatch of New Mexico, Lucas of Illinois, Wheeler of Montana, and Fulbright of Arkansas. On the Republican side, Senators Bridges of New Hampshire, Wiley of Wisconsin, and Ball of Minnesota are in the running, among others. It's still nip and tuck who will get the nod from the caucuses or steering groups in the two parties. But here's a point to remember. Both the Democrats and the Republicans have a sort of private understanding, have had it for some time, an unofficial rule that no 2 senators from the same party and the same state may be appointed to major committee assignments, which means that Senator Wheeler of Montana on the Democratic side and Senator Wiley of Wisconsin have 2 strikes against them to begin with. And I have it on the best authority that Senator Taft of Ohio is not seeking a post on the Foreign Relations Committee. On the Democratic side, administration forces are firmly in the saddle, which means that any Democratic senator who has even been called an isolationist probably won't have a chance to win a position. And a firm majority for international collaboration is thus assured. And 2 fairly sure bets for assignments will be Senators Hatch and Lucas. President Roosevelt set out once again today to head off a serious collision on foreign policy in the Senate. At his press radio conference, the chief executive took notice of the mounting snowball of discussion over the differences among the allies, political differences. Here's the way the president put it. Close coordination does exist among Moscow, London, and Washington. It's perfectly natural, the president said, for anyone who has to write all the time or speak for public consumption to lose sight of the difference between principles and details in collaboration. If you establish principles, he added, they serve as a guide. He agreed there are differences among the allies. Some of them are important, and some are not so important. He did not say, however, whether they disagreed in principle. The president hinted that the differences concern political and territorial readjustments in Europe, that the set of principles we have are interpreted differently in the different capitals. And he added he didn't hope to settle all these differences at his forthcoming meeting with Prime Minister Churchill and Marshal Stalin. And here's the rest of the news. President Roosevelt has endorsed the James F. Burns prescription for solving the labor shortage and settling the conflict between the War Labor Board and various employers and unions. He would draft 4F men for industry, and he would give the War Labor Board congressional authority to back up its rulings. Meanwhile, the Manpower Commission is moving in once again with a demand that able-bodied men working in amusement centers and nightclubs get out into war plants. And at the same time, non-war employers in war centers are threatened with a legal boycott on materials unless they lend their overseeing help to war industries. And that's what happened in Washington today.
John W. Vandercook will return with some more late news. Friends, if you are starting out the new year with a miserable cold, remember, take good care of yourself. And for prompt relief from that dull, stuffed-up, ache-all-over distress, try Alka-Seltzer. Use Alka-Seltzer as a soothing gargle, too, if your cold causes a sore throat. Of course, it's always wise to avoid drafts and get your daily vitamins. And don't forget your Alka-Seltzer. Ask your druggist for that large economy-size package. It contains 3 times as many Alka-Seltzer tablets as the smaller size at only twice the price. Now, back to the NBC newsroom.
Moscow. The Russians indicate the kind of battle that's taking place for Budapest by reporting their gains in blocks of buildings. 900 such blocks in the higher Buda half of the Hungarian capital are now held by the Red Army. Key Axis defense points in the Danube city are being systematically demolished by heavy artillery fire. And that's the news of the world. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer. Until tomorrow evening at this same time, goodbye from the newsroom in New York.
Remember our other News of the World program featuring Robert St. John over these same stations tomorrow morning at 10:15 Eastern wartime. And remember this, too. For prompt relief from an occasional acid upset stomach, be wise. Alkalize with Alka-Seltzer. This is Charles Lyon. This is the National Broadcasting Company.